Welcome to the Gentleman Ultra Podcast. We bring nostalgia, history, and tales from both within and beyond Calcio's four white lines. This is Italian football through our eyes. This is the Gentleman Ultra.
Welcome back to the third edition of the Gentleman Ultra Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Hall, and joining me today, I have Neil Morris, an Englishman in Spain who unusually is brought into the culture, learned the language, and surprisingly isn't homesick. I also have Emmett Gates, an Irishman in China who I suppose has also learned the language. Otherwise, communication would perhaps be a bit comical, perhaps as comical as Jack Charlton commentating on the old Yugoslavia. Our old friend Luca is absent today. I'm told he's also abroad in Spain, added to the myth of his ethnicity. I mean, Luke is surely Italian. Ramon, for me, I'm going Argentinian with that. And Hodge, I can't get past Steve Hodge. That's as English as it gets. Right, without further ado, Emmett, you're new to this. Great writer on the Gentleman Ultra. Introduce yourself.
Thanks very much, Richard. A nice introduction. So I'm an Irishman currently living in the smoggy capital of Beijing. Been living here for about 8 months or so. Last year I was living in Molfetta, which is in Puglia, in Italy, small town in Puglia, about 20 minutes or so from Bari. Obviously, like all of us, been a fan of Italian football going back to the mid-90s and the Gazzetta Football Italia era. I'm a Juve fan from the sins. Through one Roberto Baggio. I've been writing for the Gentleman Ultra for a couple of years, maybe. That's just a brief introduction about
two quick questions straight away. First of all, one stadium I want to go to is San Nicola in Bari. Did you get to go there? And second of all, my other little ambition around Bari, and I know this is off topic, so excuse me, but the little cliff top restaurant, two things I really want to do. But first, San Nicola is the main one.
Yeah, I went to, funny, it was about this time last year, I went to see Bari and Verona, Hellas. Obviously, Hellas at the time were top of the table with Giampaolo Pazzini up front. So me and a Barese friend of mine, he was like, oh, come to the game. I was like, yeah, really want to go. And it was a classic Serie B, 3 o'clock on a Saturday kickoff. The weather was really nice. The San Nicola was about a third full. But it's a really architecturally it's known as the petal for the design of it, like flowers, petals on the flower. The area around it is really run down. You can tell that they haven't invested anything in and around the San Nicola, but the stadium itself is still architecturally impressive, despite it being, what, nearly 30 years old now at this point?
Yeah, it was built for 90, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one. I think it was one of the only few stadiums that was built from scratch for Italia 90. And I mean, it still holds up, but again, it's blighted by a running track, which hampers all... Yeah. Italian stadium.
Neil, so Neil, just San Nicola for you, because Emmett's gone petal, I'm going spaceship. What are you thinking?
Maybe a petal-shaped spaceship would be the compromise there. I think one of our other writers, Mark, Neil was actually, he's a big Bari fan, and he was there again yesterday, I think, at the stadium. So we'll get him to give the final decision on the style of the stadium.
I didn't realise Mark was there yesterday. That's brilliant.
I think so. Maybe get him on to chat about it at some point, I reckon.
Ah, good stuff. See how Fabio Grosso is getting on.
Yeah. I think...
Sorry, go on, Emmett.
No, I was just going to say, I think there's talk of them renovating the San Nicola, and they're trying to reduce it to between 40 and 55,000.
That make a lot of sense. And
I think they've consulted the architect, the original architect who built it, that he said, yes, it can be reduced and get rid of the athletics track. I would love to see Bari back in Serie A because they think they would bring a big following. I had many friends there and they were like, the opinion was that if they get into Serie A, the stadium would be filled every week because obviously Bari have yo-yoed the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And I know a few friends that Italian fans, as we know, can be quite fickle. They won't go to the stadium if they're in Serie B, but once they get to Serie A, they'll all be in their numbers, hiding back.
Well, unless David Platt gets back there soon, that's not happening, I would have thought, but I'd like to see it as well. But, okay, just we're going to move on from that because I could genuinely talk about Bari for quite a while with that because, anyway, I'm not going to because it's too easy because they're such an interesting club, especially that whole stadium issue. But I asked you guys a question like I did last week, and just because it got a bit of popular feedback, I was only messing around actually a little bit. So what I'm going to do is just give you a couple of clues and guess the player, okay?
Yep.
So,
okay.
I'm Italian. I'm born in 1964, which, saving you do the maths, it makes me 53 now. Okay, I used to play midfield. My clubs, and I'm not going to give you these in order. Napoli, Lecce, Roma, and Sturm Graz. I've also managed a couple of teams as well. I started managing with Foggia in 2004-2005. I've not had the best career with it. Gallipoli, 2008-2010. I actually did manage, you mentioned Verona before. I actually managed them also in 2010 for a very, very brief spell. And from 2013-2015, I managed Lebanon, interestingly. And I was... they thought I was going to be the star of the 1990 World Cup. Actually outclassed by the man I mentioned before, Roberto Baggio.
Andrea Cannavale?
No, good shout, but no. I think that's probably because the Napoli link of maybe... It was Cannavale-Napoli? Yeah. So, okay, I'm going to give you a bit more of a clue. I played 318 times for Roma, scoring 49 goals.
Giuseppe Giannini?
Yes, well done. Yeah. Well done. There's a couple of more clues there. They're just going to come about the fact of Il Principe, the prince, of course. And then, hopefully I was going to say he's the predecessor of the excellent Francesco Totti. Well done. That is a cracking shout. That took longer than last time. I'm quite pleased with that one.
No, really good.
Please.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the spell at Sturm Graz that put me off. I was like,
yeah, I forgot about that when I looked it up. And the Lebanon one, I didn't realize it. Like at the moment, the odd thing is, right? I remember Giannini, and you know, like we were talking before just briefly about Fabio Grosso. You know, you remember certain players and the coaching crews, but Foggia was started out in 2004. He's been had an awful coaching career. Latina is only the head of youth. 2017 alone, Latina, head of the youth team. Then he's put, and I listen, I'll admit when I don't know something. Racing Roma, anybody?
Yeah.
No.
Uncasano Fondi, no? So, yeah, no, I've, interesting.
I know about Fondi because I think that's the team that the guys that now own Banana, Unicasano. I think they're the guys. They own a university in Rome, and they took over Fondi, and I think they did quite well with them in Serie D, was it? But they then sold up and took over at Tanana, and I think they're the guys in charge of there now. So that's
cool. And, that's an impressive shout on that team because I can't say I haven't heard of him. And considering last time I was in Rome as well, I was actually looking to see if there are any more games on other than the Lazio game. So maybe worth a look when I go this year. But okay, just want to move on a little bit quickly because obviously this week we saw the passing of Ray Wilkins. And there's been a lot said about it on different, you know, channels and people more eloquent than us. And, you know, obviously people who've known him. And it's quite strange in the way that the reaction's been in some respects because, not strange is the wrong word. It's been quite nice because what it's been an appreciation of is someone who can actually, a footballer who's before his time, a footballer who, you know, was actually criticised quite a lot, especially at Manchester United for actually being able to pass the ball. It sounds crazy, really. A player who, you know, didn't want to play that old school, getting in the mix type of football, who's criticised for sideways passing, but wanted to control the ball, wanted to love the ball, and a player who, you know, when we call ourselves, you know, the Gents and Ultra, it really just about is being about the fact that I, you know, someone, British people, Irish people from outside of the UK, as well, you know, the European guys we've got, who just actually sort of just go and look at things with different eyes. And from my point, the biggest gentleman of all was, in some respects, Ray Wilkins. One of the things that I really liked about him was his honesty and his approach, that what he would talk about when he talked about Italian football. For me, I didn't see him at Milan. You know, I missed that. I didn't really, my earliest memories of Ray Wilkins were at QPR, probably when he was there, in a footballing sense. But that, for me, Ray Wilkins was the co-commentator on Football Italia. And I think from everyone talks about Ray Wilkins, as I said before, in their own element of how they remember him and what was important. And for me, I'm going to take you back to that Football Italia time. I'm sure you guys have got different things as well. But for me, Luca, who's obviously not with us today, wrote an article about his time in Milan. And that energy, that passion that he had, that he learned from Milan, and his time there, was really put back into the commentary in Channel 4, and he did it so well. And I think for me personally, you know, he was very good at being very astute and relating, you know, these amazing players we saw at the time. He was able to translate. And also, you've got to remember that time when football wasn't prominent on TV as it is now, and we had so much information in our heads 24/7. This was a time where that Ray Wilkins almost had like half an hour, and you're watching all these players. And now we'll go and watch the game. We'll watch Torino Inter in probably an hour's time, and you'll know every single player, because the information is there. We didn't know these guys. And Ray Wilkins was able to tell us why these guys were good, what they were doing, and why they played, more importantly, why they played the game so well. And I think that a lot of that, we have a piece that Luca wrote back in November 2017 called Reminiscing About Ray, and how Ray Wilkins helped AC Milan on their path to revival. And at the time, it was an incredible time when Maradona had left Barca for Napoli. We had Rummenigge left Bayern to join Inter. You know, the likes of Zico, Falcao, Socrates and Michel Platini. All of these players had entered Serie A. And Milan, you know, weren't the Milan that we all remember now. You know, they were coming back up. And he, under Nils Lidholm, was a big inspiration there. And the fact that they looked to him and recognised outside of the UK his talent was incredible. I think it's a huge test, you know, a huge credit to him that they took him on at that time. And one of my favourite quotes from him was at the time when he said, "I only became a fresh professional at 27 when he actually went to Milan because of the dietary things. And he took everything out of the game, everything the game offered him. He wanted to learn, and he wanted to not only take it for himself, but then he wanted to give back. And for me, you know, we talked about it before on another podcast where people don't embrace the culture. They don't go out and want to take in everything that's surrounding them. But Ray Wilkins did. And, you know, I think that the biggest thing for me on Ray Wilkins is when Lucas started the article, he has a quote, and he just says, "I went to Milan and I had an absolute ball of a time." And for me, that's Ray Wilkins. So that's my little part of it. But guys, I mean, Neil, you said to me before that you've got a few memories of Ray from, I think, was it the 82 World Cup?
Yeah, Richard, 1982. I mean, that was probably my first memory of, you know, World Cups, international. Very young at the time, obviously. It's quite a long time ago now. But I just remember that England team back then, led by Ron Greenwood, I think was probably quite an underrated coach, really, during his time as England. Led them to first World Cup in 12 years at the time. And they just had a, you know, really good team then. You had obviously, Ray Wilkins and Brian Robson, Steve Coppell in midfield, really, you know, solid, creative midfield there. Glenn Hoddle on the bench. And then a back four of Butcher, Mills, Thompson and Sampson with Peter Shilton in goal.
Glenn Hoddle on the bench.
Yeah. When he was just sort of breaking through then. Trevor Francis was up front. Mariner, Tony Woodcock as well, I think, was inside at the time. It's just a really good team. And, you know, I remember getting... Not only was it my first real World Cup memory, first memory of really watching England and obviously Italy as well. And I just remember, you know, England had a brilliant start to that tournament. I think they won all their games in the first group stage, beat, you know, Platini's France in the opening game. And then, you know, back then they had two group stages, and in the second group stage they happened to be drawn against West Germany and Spain. Obviously, Spain were the hosts, and they drew both games 0-0 and exited the tournament without, you know, without having lost a game. And then that was the same tournament, you know, obviously Italy went on to win after, and I think Italy didn't win any of their first three games, you know, in the group stage. That they, you know, they drew against Poland, Peru and Cameroon and only went through to the next stage because they scored one more goal than Cameroon. And then obviously the rest is history in terms of Italy. But yeah, watching Ray Wilkins back then, you know, he just, so, like you said about the way he played the game, he was elegant, almost laid back. And you know, looking back now, it's, you know, you see he had that sort of European style of play, which was, you know, very different to the sort of rugged game that, you know, England were used to at the time. And I think Ron Greenwood encouraged that. You know, that England team did have a bit of flair, and he did look to, you know, how other teams, other countries were playing. Yeah, and you know, Ray Wilkins moved to Milan at a time when, you know, Milan, they were quite dark days, to be honest.
Certainly were,
you know, and really was part of that revival. I mean, obviously, you know, he fell out of favour at some point. I think that was when the takeover happened. I think Farina was the owner before Berlusconi came in, and he had a few, should we say, legal issues, and fled the country. He's actually living up here in Spain now, actually, growing up in, he's got a farm up in Barcelona, but he fled the country. I think he went to South Africa or somewhere for a couple of years, and, you know, Berlusconi took over, Donadini was signed, and Ray Wilkins was kind of frozen out at that point. But yeah, I mean, I just really, you know, he was part of my early memories of watching England, watching, you know, the World Cup. And it's just a shame that, you know, in two out of three podcasts now, and we're having to, you know, pay tribute to people that have left us, and you know, let's hope we don't have too many more in the near future.
No, absolutely. It's not. I think one of the things is, it's you know, the fact that, when I suppose a positive spin on that is the fact that, you know, unfortunately, when people do leave, I think that's part of the beauty of football in some respects, that, you know, people do leave that impact, as whether it's, we talked about David Astoria and the impact, it's very different impacts of Ray Wilkins, that, you know, but. You know, it's the fact that people can, I think that, you know, whether it's someone who sometimes goes under the radar, and it is, you know, a very workman-like person who can just give us lessons about professionalism, professions about, you know, how to conduct your life in the right way, or someone who, you know, lives outside their comfort zone, you know, and goes and takes those chances, goes and takes those risks.
You mentioned about, you know, I think we touched on in the last podcast about players going abroad, and Ray Wilkins was one of those that really went and embraced it. I mean, I remember him saying that, you know, when he first arrived in Italy, it was a real shock to the system. Similar to, you know, back in, you know, when Eddie Firmani went, which we discussed last time, and the training regime was so much harder, so much different. And, you know, even back in the 80s, England hadn't really caught up with that, you know, the real, you know, fitness regimes and diets and stuff like that. I mean, it probably wasn't until, you know, I'd say probably when Wenger arrived in England that really, really changed.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, Ray Wilkins said, you know, he it's just a massive shock to his system, but he threw himself into it. And he said that his time in Milan was the fittest time of his career. He was never fitter than when he was at Milan. And, you know, I think he kept that up when he came back, and it's probably testament to that, the fact that he was still playing, you know, when he was 40, you know, at a professional level. So, you know, he kept himself in really good shape. And like you said about him being a, you know, a gentleman of the game, I mean, all these stories that have come out in the last week about things he'd done for people and stuff. I mean, there was a story on one of the sports radio stations about how he'd seen a homeless guy at the station, and he was like an ex-soldier, and Ray just sat down, chatted to him, helped him out with a bit of cash, took him for a coffee and stuff, and the guy phoned into the station and told the story and said, you know, that it was literally the catalyst, helped him to get his life back on track, you know, just the fact that someone showed an interest, someone cared, and you know, from that moment on, he said it changed his life, and he never really got a chance to thank him for that. And, you know, and loads of other stories have come out as well, and everyone, you know, universally agrees that, you know, Ray Wilkins was just a really, really nice guy.
It's simple to the facts of either. I think Luca's got a quote in his piece where, you know, it's bit about being quite humble as well. You know, that you were right before when you said that, you know, Donadoni arrived. There's also, and the quote was when you've got from Ray Wilkins, when he said, when you've got the likes of Hullett, Van Basten and Rijker coming in here, not too many players who can keep them out of the team. Mark Haley and I certainly weren't good enough to keep them out. And it's that no regrets kind of thing. But Emmett, I mean, have you got any particular memories of Ray Wilkins?
A bit like you, Richard. Ray Wilkins was kind of before my time. My first memory of him, quite like yourself, was him as a QPR player. That was kind of when I first came across him. But in the wake of his untimely passing, I went on to YouTube and looked at some videos of Ray Wilkins during his time at Milan. And it is kind of, as Neil alluded to, it's unfortunate that he went to Milan at a time when they were in a state of flux. It was kind of pre-Berlusconi, and it was after the Toto Nauro scandal. So they were a mid-table team at best, really, during that time. But I did find a funny anecdote. I was watching, he only scored 2 goals for Milan. One was a really good half volley against Avellino, which flew into the top corner. And then his last goal was against Sampdoria, but it was a Sampdoria with Graeme Souness.
Oh, yes. Seen that goal, actually.
There's a funny clip. It shows there's a corner. This is a Milan corner. And Graeme Souness, being typical Graeme Souness, is giving a bollocking to Sampdoria teammates. And Wilkins is standing beside him and they're saying something in English, but he's laughing and Souness is laughing, but Souness is giving off at the same time as he's laughing. And they're just chatting to Wilkins beside the post, waiting on this corner to come in. And find that funny. But from watching the footage of him, he seems like he's a player out of time. Yeah. If he had been born 10 years later, and if he had played in England maybe from the late 80s into the 90s, when the attitude towards his type of midfielder was slightly starting to change, I maybe think he would have got more recognition. He, as Neil said, he seemed a more European-esque type of a player. And I think it was fitting that in the end he did go, because he went to PSG after...
Yeah.
After Milan, he left. He went to PSG, I think, in 87. And he stayed at PSG he played 15 games. And then he went to Rangers in Scotland. So my memories of him predominantly are Ray Wilkins, the commentator, and not the player.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I like the story about Souness. I think that's, you know, players like that knew the game, really knew the game. And we didn't, you know, in the UK anyway, we didn't have that many players of that ability at the time. And like you both have touched on, you know, there are players you look back on, and I'd say Andras Brehm is a good example. For me, he's the modern day fullback that was way before his time, way, way, way before his time, who could play now. And you could put Ray Wilkins into many, many teams. And I think that's testament to him. And, you know, but talking of Football Italia and the commentary, one of the things when I was talking about before that, for me, you know, I was 1990, I was 10. And then, so you're starting to watch, has to watch Football Italia from the beginning. And a lot of probably the explanations were basic, but football's a basic game. And Ray Wilkins was able to take what seemed at the time, you know, this very complex Italian, you know, you had the sometimes defensive, sometimes it was a Sacchi breaking out of that mold. There's a lot of change in the time, and Wilkins was always made to simplify it. I think that so many people relate to Football Italia, partly is, of course, down to him. Of course, James Richardson and Gary Blin and all the rest of the people involved with it. But Ray Wilkins was a big part of that, and sometimes was able to simplify things and make things, you know, he's quite cultured in his approach. But one of the reasons, obviously, Emmett, I mean, Football Italia plays a massive, obviously, part in your life as well. Just as I think that it does with everyone who comes on here or anyone who's written for us. And you wrote a fantastic series of articles, Football Italia at 25, celebrating Gazzetta's greatest Gualaccios. And I mean, we've got one we're just going to have a bit of a chat about, because I think it's right in the basis of obviously the fantastic James Richardson programme, BT Sport, last weekend that celebrated Football Italia. It's without that, without Football Italia, this wouldn't be here. None of this would be here. This site wouldn't be here. And you know, the fact that it's so nice to see people who just love this, and we're all quite involved with it. little story before I moved to UM, but I was in the gym the other day and someone turned around to me and just said to me straight away, because someone he's played football with, and you know, this guy never talked to me about Italian football at all. He knows how much I'm into it, and that's fine, but we'll talk about different types of football, maybe, you know, the obvious stuff, how United did on the weekend, the Barcelona Real Madrid game, whatever it is. And but he'll never come and talk, you know, he's not going to talk to me about Brescia versus bloody, you know, Bari or whatever. But the point is, he won't even talk to me about Milan Juve. But after that show, he turned around to me and he went, "Oh my God, did you watch that? My God, all the memories came flooding back." And it was great. And I took more pleasure in that, in the sense of we do this day in, day out, and sort of really look back and feel quite a lot for it. But to see someone else who's not really that into it, that it had an impact on, was really cool. And I just thought, I think that's testament to what that was at the time. Reading back on your piece, and I just wanted to, first of all, I want to know why you wrote it, why it came out. I'm going to do a little countdown on the goals afterwards, but that must have been some fun looking back over all that. How did you even narrow those goals down?
It was a long week, I'll just put it that way. The idea, I don't know why. I'm really good for anniversaries and years and numbers, and it was over last summer. So it was summer 2017, and I was at home, and I can't remember. I think I was watching a film, and the film came out in 1982. I really don't remember what the film was, and it's like, huh. And immediately in my head, I was like, oh, it's 25 years since James Richardson sat in front of the TV and changed our lives. Well, changed my life, certainly. And obviously Richard, probably your life and a lot of people's lives with Gazzetta. So I was like, I want to do something to commemorate the 25th anniversary of probably the greatest football European magazine show that has ever been produced or will ever likely be produced. So I was kind of thinking, what could I do that was different? I didn't want to just do, you know, a chronological, you know, this is how it started, this is the peak, and then the Channel 4 taking it off. I wanted to do something unique, a different take on it. And so I sat down with a piece of paper and kind of rattled off a few, you know, a unique take. And I was like, what is genuinely remembered, apart from the players, the fans, the stadiums, the goals? Everyone, I'm sure Richard, you definitely remember, everyone remembers where they were when they saw Alvaro Recoba smash two in against Brescia from 7,000 yards out, you know. Everyone remembers. So I was like, goals, that's you know, that's the love of the sport, it's what we all go, you know, good goals. So like, I'll do 25 good goals. So then I went on to YouTube and I went through luckily some angel compiled lists of the best goals of Serie A of each individual season of the Gazzetta era. So each season, each video was maybe 10 to 15 minutes long. So I basically sat through and watched every single video. So that took about a week, and I would make notes of like, okay, that goal, you know, it's considered. So I'd make a list and then I would whittle it down. But I had some absolute certainties, like one of the Recoba goals was like, that's definitely in there, has to be. George Weah's famous goal against Verona. You know, I had definite certainties, but there was a lot of goals I'd never seen before or I'd forgotten them. I was like, like Yuri Jakayev's.
Oh, the scissor kick. Oh, yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I'd forgot about it. And then when I saw it, I was like, that's definitely in there, you know. So it was kind of the foundation of it was to celebrate Football Italia, because it definitely changed my life, and it still to this day has impacted me. And I think like it'd be something nice to do.
Oh, massive. I couldn't agree. I mean, it's one of those things that I think that when you were saying about look, going through, taking a week to go through all the goals, it's one of those things I think sometimes, you know, find ourselves doing, but as much as sometimes, you know, yeah, there's a lot of work, and you can tell just by reading and watching these got the amount of work that went into this is obvious. But it's one of those things where it's as much as it's a chore, it's a pleasure. And I think that to go back and to relive those things, you know, it still holds a special place for all of us, because I think it's probably going to be a continued theme in this podcast that people may want to. I'm going to stop trying to say this every single time. But it is one of those things where, and I mean, James Horncastle, Gabriele Marcotti, and of course James Richardson did a really good job of talking about this on the show last weekend, but it was a situation where football was a different era. It was a different world, and it was about Italy, the culture, and everything surrounding it. And these goals, it's like you say, because there's less information in the world back then, and because we were younger, and because memories stick earlier, and all these different things, you're right. You do remember where you are when these goals are scored. And I think that's what makes this piece so good, because it's not just about the fact of, maybe it's age, but last season, if we said the top 10 goals, I'd go, oh yeah, I remember all of those. You asked me where I was for them, I don't remember. Some of these here, you know, I remember. I mean, if we go through, you look at Del Piero against Fiorentina, that goal, you just say that and you know what it is. You already know what the goal is. It's incredible. You know, I mean, you watched the clip of it, and that was Del Piero really announcing himself. I remember going and playing football after that game. I remember literally going and playing football after that. And, you know, bizarrely with one of my friends, you know, you're commentating and you're trying to recreate it. You know, Francesco Totti against Parma in 97-98. Again, it's one of those goals where it's etched in the memory. You hadn't kind of seen a goal like that before. It was one of those things where, you know, and also because it's Totti, it's because he's Rome and he's from the, he's literally Rome, and but it's still early days there. And you remember watching this, I mean, you didn't know at the time, you know, he's a legend in the making. Going back to Giannini, I remember watching Totti and going, as if he'll be as good as Giannini. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was wrong, perhaps, possibly, maybe. But maybe I was wrong. I still like Giannini. But again, you know, Rakoba, Brescia. I mean, Rakoba, what's amazing about him? You're not going to see a player like Rakoba again. People will argue me, you can tweet me and give me grief, whatever, fine, but I don't think that a player can exist like that in the game today, because it's too quick, it's too physical, it's too fast moving, and you get this languid, brilliant player with this just rocket of a left foot, you know? And then you add Zidane against, I mean, Zidane, I mean, you've got the one against Reggiana. I mean, there's so many with Zidane, but that's a special one. And then, of course, Bobby Baggio against Juventus. And as you say, quite elegantly, the touch. It's amazing. So I would just say, anyone who's not seen these, it's just if someone wants to be nostalgic, go back over some old goals. Go and read this piece. It's brilliant. But guys, I know exactly which one of those goals in Series 3 we're talking about here, by the way. Neil, which one are you going for as number one?
Well, for me, it's quite easy, but I'll just say that you know, it's no surprise that that Emmett's got Baggio at number one. Anyone that knows Emmett will not be surprised by that. And I just think
no bias involved.
And I just think it's great that obviously it's a great piece because it, you know, we can look through it and reminisce. And you know, me being slightly older than you guys, that, you know, I do forget things from that period. So it's nice to look back and remember goals. And you know, and when you look at the clips, it then inspires you to go and you look at another clip, and you end up, you know, spending a whole afternoon looking through old clips and remembering old goals. And it's great. And also, it's great, you know, because there'll be a whole, you know, load of people reading Emmett's article that probably, you know, weren't old enough at the time, didn't witness these, and can now go back and look and see what all the fuss was about. But for me, it's got to be Rakoba. I just, you know, loved him as a player, always had a bit of a fondness for the Mavericks of the game, and he certainly was one of those. And you know, to do that on your debut, and like Emmett mentioned in the piece, you know, yeah, Ronaldo was you know, all the spotlight was on Ronaldo for that game, but Rakoba came on and stole the show totally. And I agree, Richard, there's not many players could exist like that now. You know, he did, and there was a bit of inconsistency there, but there's also always that chance of that magic, and that goal, you know, it's just, you know, the way it travels just so straight. I think Emmett describes it as a rocket in the article, and it's like, it's almost like it's got some kind of guidance, stability on it. It just stays so straight, and just, you know, the power on it is incredible. And then to follow it up with another goal just a few minutes later, almost as spectacular, as incredible. I don't know. There's just something about him. You know, obviously he's from Uruguay. People have compared, and you know, Suarez to him, and there are similarities, but they're different players. He was, you know, Suarez like you say, he's a guy that can manage into get today's game. I don't know if Rakova good, but it's just great to go back and look at that. And for me, that's the number one goal of those.
Yeah. I think you said everything about that goal. And to me, I completely agree. It's also my favourite. I think, Emmett, you know, I like the way you ended that when you put in the article, when you put Alvaro Rakoba, you wonderful, inconsistent little maverick. I think that's pretty much it. That's how you sum him up. It is exactly as it is. And Neil, you're right. I mean, Uruguayans at the time, who was everyone looking at? Probably Enzo Francescoli. You know, comparing him to... There's no comparisons. That's the one thing about Rakoba that I love so much, is because you can pick a player... Many players, there's all you talk about football, like in general, pick a player and someone go, he's the next Thierry Henry, he's the next this. I mean, Thierry Henry only used because everyone's the next Thierry Henry, like everyone's the next, every Italian goalkeeper's the next Buffon, from Scufa to Meret to bloody Mattia Perrin. No one's the next Rakoba, because you can't be, because he's so different. And that for me just is why he's as good as he is. Now, Emma, now I'm guessing obviously you wrote this, so Baggio's number one, but. Other than the touch, and the touch is a big thing on this, why number one?
You're
going to say the touch.
Segueing just before I get into the reasons why I felt Baggio was number one, just to go back to Rakoba, it's kind of what you were touching on, Richard, earlier. The thing about the Rakoba goal, or the two goals, even to say, I genuinely think it's probably the best football debut you will ever see.
Yeah.
But the beauty of it was, is that it was more or less pre-internet. None of us had ever even heard of Alvaro Rakoba. But if there was a Rakoba now, everybody would know everything about him. Oh, there'd be 15-minute highlight reels on YouTube about him. There would be scouting reports. Everybody, you would have so-called experts.
Like Lautaro Martinez, who just signed for instance. We all just know about him already.
The thing with Rakoba was...
If you admit it to not knowing about him now, everyone would be like, what?
Yeah, I've known about him since he was 14. he's old news, But the thing about he was virtually unknown. None of us had heard of him. It was the pre-internet age. We had all heard of Ronaldo. It was Ronaldo's debut. This 21-year-old comes on and with a rocket of a left foot. And that's how you remember it. That's how it stays memorable, because nobody had heard of him. To me, that's the greatest thing about the Rakoba, the two Rakoba goals, was that he was so unknown. Yeah. And then he became known. Whereas today, I don't think... You could never get that again. That will never, ever
that
exist.
Impact.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that impact where you're like, oh my God, that's a player. You know, I think that's why we all remember.
That's why it's exciting.
The two Rakoba goals.
It's like, you feel like you're in the stadium, because you feel like you've come in and you're like, and it is, it's a different thing, isn't it? It's like this guy from South America. It's mystical. It's so cultured. And then bang, it's this massive explosion. And all of a sudden, it's like you realise when you're watching it, okay, this is going to be good. But like you say, everything now, we already know it. It's almost too much information.
Yeah, and I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, Richard, that it was exotic. Mm. And Rakoba kind of typified Serie A of that time. It's where it was a pre-internet age and we didn't really know a lot about it. But here's this magician from Uruguay with a left foot that could do this and none of us knows anything about it. To me, Rakoba kind of in essence sums up the Gazzetti years, because it was all pre-internet, and I don't think that will ever happen again, sadly. It, as wonderful as the internet is, it's took that surprise out of the game.
Yeah, I agree. I think we've definitely lost something with that. As much as there's pluses and pros, for all the information, for all the football we can watch, the fact that through different means we can tune into Serie B and everything else. And the world's a smaller place, but without sounding like too much of an old guy. Really quickly, because we're going to have to move on. Quickly, why Baggio number one?
All right, yes. So, personal bias aside, obviously, anybody who knows me knows I'm a Juve fan because of Baggio, and Baggio was kind of the first superstar that I fell in love with, and I mean, I thought the ponytail was wonderful looking.
You tried that one out.
No. No way was I cool enough to pull off the ponytail. That's... but I think the touch aside, it was... Brescia were near the relegation zone. Juve were going for the title with Roma. And I think Juve at that time were leading by a point or two. And it was, what, 5 minutes before the end of the game. And you have a very young Andrea Pirlo in a role that would come to define him, where Carlo Mazzoni readjusts him and put him as a regista. I mean, it's not the greatest ball Pirlo's ever played, but it's kind of, there's a fantasy about it. You know, it's Pirlo to Baggio. It's kind of like, you kind of think that they'd never play together.
Because
Baggio, yeah, it's not a bad ball, but it's obviously not Pirlo in Dortmund in 2006 quality. But Baggio makes the run, splits the defence in two, and then it is, as I said in the piece, it is the touch. Like, if you've ever played football at any meaningful level, that one of the hardest skills is to kill a ball coming from over your shoulder from a long distance, and to kill it and direct it in one touch, like not even two touches, one touch against a good goalkeeper in Edwin van der Sar. And round van der Sar with such elegance and such panache, and then to casually stroke it home with his left, like two touches, to me, it sums up Baggio. It sums up that elegance, that genius, that in a lot of ways was ignored by a lot of Italian coaches, which to me borders on criminal the way he was treated by some coaches. It's like, this is what you left on the bench. This is what you left at home. This genius that he had, to me, it's all summed up in this goal.
I completely agree. And I think what I can say to add to everything you said there is that if you ever refer to a touch as Bergkamp-esque and you are still doing it a disservice by doing that, you can only be really talking about Baggio on that goal, because it was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal.
And the thing also, you know, it wasn't like as if it was a goal that didn't mean anything. It in the end up, it went a long way and cost the Juve that title, because I think the week or the week after they went to Roma and they drew 2-2, and those drop points was what ultimately would cost Juve the title. Roma would go on to win, so it did. It, obviously, his Baggio were coming back to his old club, and obviously the relationship between Baggio and the Juve Ultras was never what it was with Baggio and Fiorentina, or Baggio and Bologna, or Baggio even Inter or Milan. He was more loved by them than he was with Juve. I think as time has passed, they recognize, okay, we had this genius, we had the best of this genius, we need to appreciate him more. But at the time, he got booed on several occasions when he went back with other teams. So it was kind of Baggio sticking one up to his old team. And it's funny, I know it's my bias for Baggio aside, it's actually against the team I support, but it's like you can't ignore the beauty of the goal.
No, absolutely incredible goal. And like you say, when it means so much as well. And, you know, again, he's one of those players that was, like you said, sadly ignored and often overlooked at the time, which is crazy. You know, I think I don't want to ponder too much on Baggio, but my first introduction to Baggio again was one of these things of sitting down in front of a television at 10 years old watching Italy, Czechoslovakia at the time. And then Baggio went and did that. And it was like, who the hell is this? Yeah. That is that impossible. It's
that goal, I think I spoke about that in one of the early podcasts. It's kind of like the Rekoba moment. It's like you didn't really know who this guy was. Just really, you know, taking notes of the Italian team for the first time, and then in the World Cup, he comes on, you know, on the pitch and does that, and it was kind of like that Rekoba moment where you just had that impact. Didn't know that much about the player, and brilliant. And that, as Emmett says in the article, he had every goal in his locker. There wasn't anything he wasn't capable of in terms of, you know, touch and finish, and you know, he's just all there. And that goal's great because it gives us a little microcosm of the future career of Pirlo as well.
Absolutely. And all made better by the commentators like the late Brian Moore and Gary Bloom as well, obviously. Right, guys, we always put a couple of questions out just to sort of end the pod. We just pick one to have a little chat about. And I'm hoping we've got one this week, Neil. Otherwise, we just look like no one listens to us.
Yeah, that's it. We've got we had a few questions. Two people asked the same question, actually, or almost the same question. We had Danny Kay, who's at DKAY_99 on Twitter, and Simon, who's at SMS19661 on Twitter. Danny asked, is Palotta's Roma project failing? And Simon, in a similar vein, said, after defeat to Barca this week, can you see Roma becoming a European super club once their stadium is built? Will all fan clubs challenge Juve's dominance? I'll let you go first on this one. Anyway.
Okay, so is Palotta failing as Roma president? I think Roma's a complicated club. Obviously, the size of Rome, you know, we all know the difficulties that Roma have had over the last, basically since Franco Sensi sold the club. The thing, Roma are a big club. I mean, there is no denying that. Even within Italy, they're a big club. But it's not like Palotta has taken over a club that's had, you know, years of success or decades of success. They have had fleeting successes. Three Scudetti in their entire history. You know, what, 9 Coppa Italias? I think his biggest feeling, well, maybe not his feeling, but I think he's put a lot of eggs in the stadium basket. And by his own admission, he hasn't worked on getting sponsorship for Roma. I mean, how many years is it now that Roma haven't had a shirt sponsor? And that has cost the club revenue. And I think the fact that they continually sell their best players year after year after year to meet financial fair play, I mean, there's a glass ceiling to that. You're only ever going to get so far. And there's also the fact that, unfortunately, at a couple of seasons where Roma were really good, they were up against Conte's Juve machine, which was it 2013-14? Juve got 102 points and Roma got a club best. It was like 85, 86 points, which in other years would have won the Scudetto by a landslide. But they just happened to peak in different... Same with Spalletti's Roma when they were up against Mourinho's Inter. Like, that was a very good Inter team. And Roma, in other years, probably would have won the league, but they just happened to peak at the same time that a stronger team peaks. But to go back to Palotta, I think he's done well. But I think the issue of the stadium is hampering Roma.
Yes, it's like all-encompassing, isn't it, at the moment? I think... but I mean, with Palotta, I mean, how long has he been in now? Is it 6 years? So, I mean, in footballing terms, it's you know, in a environment where everything's, you know, has to be done yesterday in football now, it seems like a long time. But in terms of building a project, it's probably not really that long. But for me, it's just the fact, you know, you look at the fact that he's brought in Monchi and, you know, having watched him, you know, what he did at Sevilla, you have to ask, you know, is that a director of football who's going to make them a European giant, which is the question that Simon asked. And I think, you know, Monchi, you know, he's there for a reason, and he was at Seville for a reason, and it was to make the club money. So in that respect, maybe Palotta is looking at, you know, trying to bring in more income. But as long as Monchi's at the club, they're always going to sell their best players. I mean, it's what he does. I mean, you know, he's not been there 5 minutes and, you know, Paredes and Rudiger are out the door, and all players that have only been there for, you know, a short space of time but are sold for a huge profit. I mean, Emerson as well. I mean, a year at the club, how much did they make on him? Probably 16 million or so. There's a lot of money coming in from player sales again, as Emmett mentioned, you know, always selling their best players. I don't think that's going to change when Monchi's there. I mean, the only reason you'd hire that guy is to continue doing that, is to bring in players cheap, keep them for a year or two, and then sell them on for a massive profit. So whether he is going to, you know, up the game in terms of the commercial side of things, like you said, sponsorship as well. I mean, if he's focusing it all on the direction of football, but maybe they need to look at the commercial side of it as well. And all that's going to be, you know, need to be in place if they're going to get the stadium up and running as well. Yeah, I think to say he's failed after just a few years is difficult, because I think it's going to be a very long project there.
To round off the question, there is huge potential in Roma, because last year I went to the Derby della Capitale, Lazio Roma, and I was, the stadium wasn't filled. There was maybe about 45, 50,000, but I was struck by how many Chinese tourists there was. Obviously, they're going to Rome, and they're like, ah, we'll take in the game. You know, there was a lot of Chinese tourists. So there's definitely a lot of potential for Roma to make a lot of money once they get into the new stadium. But at the same time, I kind of feel that it will, Roma will be like an Italian Arsenal. Is that the financing to build the stadium, Roma will continually sell players to repay the loans that they will take out to build the stadium. Yeah. So I don't think Roma selling their players will stop once the stadium is built. I think it'll continue.
I think you're spot on, because I think everything that you guys have said have really brought it home, because I think to kind of understand Roma's, kind of to understand the Roman people. And, you know, if you look at modern Roman culture, it's kind of merged between this mix of the contemporary and the ancient. And arguably, I'd say that that's where it's kind of most complete. So when you look at Rome, that, you know, when you... Roman sport and Roman politics, Roman culture is so complex in the way that it wants to be. And, like I said before, about mixing the old and the new traditions with the populace and the way they look at things. And I think the club has always been in the making of its people. And marketing is something that obviously Pelotta is going to, you know, try and sell, capitalise on the appeal of calcio, in a sense, like you say. And that there is things that he can do. But it's managing that within the nature of the club. And we saw the issues with Francesco Totti when he's at the club with Spalletti and managing that. It's not that easy. You know, it is a hotbed for football. But then we look at the fact of, you know, I always relate, you can relate to Lazio as well. And there's a reason that these clubs of the capital have had so little success in that sense. And now, I think with Pelotta coming in, I think what he's doing, I think your point about these sort of Italian Arsenal is quite a good one, but I don't think it's a bad place to be. Someone's asking me, is Roma going to be challenging, you know, on the main European stage, getting to the last four of the Champions League every season in the next 10 years? I'm going to say no, because I don't see that as possible in that time. But then there's not many teams that can get to that level. We can cite the Milan clubs for that, you know, the big powerhouses. And it'd be, you know, even we've seen what happens with massive investment, even in those clubs, and how difficult it is. I think what Pelotta's doing in some respect, he is managing. He's not without issues with the ultras and various different groups as well that have challenged him there. But I think what he is doing is, in some respects, he's not changing everything straight away. And he's appreciating the surroundings, appreciating his audience in a sense, and slowly implementing change. And I think you can see that now with the stadium move, if and when that is complete, it will change the dynamic of a club, of what it is. And, you know, it's like when you were saying before about the Derby della Capitale and the fact that there is a lot of tourists going and it isn't completely full. There's a lot of issues that have surrounded that derby for some time. A lot of issues with the ultras, a lot of issues with the Rome itself. And this is what I was going back to, you know, obviously with the situation with the stands, what the prefects of Rome did as safety measures, the sort of backdrop of that and the backlash against that. And all of these things are going on at one time. And I think what Pelotta is doing is just gently trying to change things. So for me, if you're answering the question, is the project flawed? No. Are they going to be a European superpower? No. But that doesn't mean that with what they're putting in place in 5 or 10 years, you would have a stronger team, which is not lost its roots, not lost the fact that it is part of Rome, but also is still a modern football club. So anyway, who knows what will happen with Roma, and hopefully, you know, what the guys have said, you know, we will see a Roma that's a lot more stable. Well, stable's the wrong word, a lot more progressive in the future. And talking of progressive, hopefully this podcast is doing the same thing. We're going to move on next week or the next fortnight again, get the next episode out. But before we go, I'd like to thank Neil, as always, for coming on, and also to Emmett as well. Thank you guys for your contribution. Thank you for the work you do for the site as well. Any final things you want to say before we go?
No, I'll just point out that, you know, with Simon's question there about Roma, mentioning them the defeat to Barca. Just point out that we are recording this before the second leg, so apologies to them if they do make a remarkable comeback.
Great stuff. Yeah, well, fingers crossed for them. Fingers crossed, because it would be good to see it, and that'd be a hell of a game. All right, guys. Well, until next time, arrivederci.